ready for the interview. In a few, get a cue live on a laptop. Watch what I'm gonna do. Welcome to the show. Let them know we got a point of view. Hey, yo, let's have a combo. Say what you feel, be real. That's the motto. Real talk, pronto. Dr. D, PhD, hit an intro. Hold up, wait. Gotta be social, network, global, a home for the locals. Gotta be social, network, global, a home for the locals.
All right, Rebecca, I am so excited to speak with you, and I've watched your TED Talk several times now, and it's fantastic, very eye-opening. So thank you for being here.
Great, thank you for having me.
So how does an economist get into the game of love?
Yeah, in a way, you know, it has to do with my day job. So I'm a PhD in economics, who works in international development. And I focus on people and economics, so on human development. Already in my work, I study what makes families and relationships stick, what makes them stronger. And I've also, in my life previously, when I was younger, not been too successful at dating. So I really wanted to use my scientific toolkit to get behind that and really understand it better. And I documented that in a TED Talk. So that really helped dig up, the economist toolkit for success in dating. And in a way, I specialize on the intersection between love and economics through my day job. And I've lectured on that in a few universities and advised clients on that.
How was that information received? Because I think on the general public, we see economics in a very different light. We don't always associate this with love and connection and relationships.
So you'd be surprised what economists have researched, right? They really don't stop at anything. So for anybody who researches the subject, it wasn't that big a surprise. But for the public, they probably thought, you know, since when is there any data that can help me along here, and why would it be relevant? But if you start digging and pulling out a few nuggets, it amuses people and also, and opens some eyes.
It definitely amused me when I watched your TED Talk. And I think kind of your whole thing was like, well, you can't guarantee the results, but you could put the odds in your favor. Let's talk a little bit about how you can put the odds in your favor and what you've discovered through your research in this.
Absolutely. That's important, right? We need to sort of step back from wanting to control the result. All this research doesn't give you a guarantee that you get exactly what you set out for, but you definitely, you can change the odds in your favor. And what you can do is, first of all, really figure out what you want, right? What are your preferences? What is the type of person you want to relate to, you want to spend time with? Sit down with yourself and you know, make a list even. What are your non-negotiables? And then think about, where do people like that actually usually gather? This is important because what the research shows is, if you don't do that, you're driven by opportunity. You're really driven by who you meet by chance. And people adjust their preferences to whom they meet by chance. And then you've adjusted to your environment rather than really choosing what you want. And so what some people that work with speed dating data found out, that only 1% in the end, 1% of your choices are explained by preferences. The rest is explained by opportunities. So, you know, you say you want a person that has a certain interest or a certain education level, or the person smokes or doesn't smoke. You cave in on all of that depending on circumstance. So the lesson from then would be, you know, choose where you find the person that you want, and then choose your environment and go there. Another important factor to sort of influence your odds is the gender ratio. So assuming, you know, we are 90% of the population is heterosexual, so the different genders mix. As a woman, you want to look for an environment where men outnumber women, and as a man, the other way around. And that's the gender ratio, right? And now in the US, you have quite some variation on this gender ratio between urban and rural areas and between West Coast and East Coast. So on the West Coast, for example, in the Bay Area alone, you have like 114 men, 400 women, right, of marriageable age. It's quite a difference. So there are a lot of men who are looking for a partner and not finding one on the West Coast. And oddly enough, on the East Coast, in the big metropolis in New York and Washington, D.C., you have the opposite. You have women outnumbering men. And it's not easy to negotiate for what you want in a dating market where, you know, you're in the majority and you might be competing for attention. So you want to go where you're in the minority. And that's, yeah, it varies by geography, but it also varies by workplace, right? You know, say the army or engineering has more men than women on average. And, you know, primary school teaching and early childhood development and yoga and psychology has more women on average. So you can, you know, you can really choose your environment and with that influence your bargaining power.
It's so interesting. I remember, I think, the part about a German engineering firm in the TED Talk. And that was funny about, so if you want to, you know, join a German engineering firm to put the odds in your favor. I can't remember depending on the gender you were saying, but it's very interesting information. How do you mention about your preferences? Why have we struggled to actually sit down and write those things down about ourselves that we want versus just the convenience or the opportunity aspect of it?
You know, there is a very strong, I guess, romantic narrative that we all absorb through fairy tales and other stories that there's only one person in the universe and you'll converge to finding that person. Now, in reality, that's not true, right? In reality, you know, a good relationship, a good marriage could maybe happen with five good people in your life, not with everyone, but maybe with five good people. And then you have an element of choice. You have a task of finding those five and making a choice and, you know, upping your odds with at least one of them. But waiting passively will not get you there. Waiting passively is the recipe of, you know, letting opportunities determine what you do. But it's this dominant romantic narrative that's it's still rehashed in movies sometimes that, you know, it's all serendipitous. All you need to is, you know, expected and it's going to happen. And it's not quite realistic. But the other thing is, I think that's one reason. The other reason is that, you know, it's a generational thing. And I hope Gen Z doesn't have that problem anymore. But maybe our generation, older generations, weren't encouraged so much to express what they like and what their preferences are and really be outspoken about it. And it's something you have to then relearn as an adult and say, wait, I do have a preference around this. I do like this. I don't like that. And it's, you know, it's almost a human right. But some of us have to relearn that to you know, get in touch with our preferences and express them.
What about for people in our audience who are not looking for the opposite gender or looking for same gender relationships? What does the statistics bear out on that in terms of creating more of favor, the odds?
So this is, the literature is only emerging on that, right? Sadly, there are not that many papers out there. But what comes up is that, you know, it's in a way, it's a little bit the opposite around with the gender ratio. So normally where you find, you know, then your own gender in the majority, you'll have a better chance of also finding gay people in your own gender, just by mere odds. And then of course there, you know, their venues, their interests, sometimes it's clearly a community that's very active. It may be active in the arts and the environment and, you know, organized clearly by a community open to same-sex relationships. And you can seek that out, those venues out and sort of express your values and get, you know, going on whatever social cause you have, where also the gay community is involved and is organizing and be there. And one interesting statistic, so one paper I did, this a Canadian professor who works a little bit with more recent data on same-sex relationships. And in the US, actually, most same-sex households are married. You have quite a high incidence of gay marriage. And the statistics are a bit different for same-sex female relationships to same-sex male relationships. There are a lot of committed same-sex relationships for women that move in quickly together, but they're on average a little less stable than the same-sex male relationships, where apparently there's the courtship is longer, the thinking is longer before you commit, and those relationships are usually fairly stable.
So fascinating. It's interesting stuff. You know, this kind of reminds me of, I remember when I was growing up and here in the U.S. about, like, if you wanted to be in a certain profession, you would move to a certain place because the odds were higher. For instance, if someone wanted to be an actor or in theater, they needed to be in New York City or in L.A. to increase the odds that they would actually get into that business and have security for that. Is this a similar, sounds like a similar concept, but in terms of like gender and where the population of people, where they're at, to give yourself just a better chance? Almost seems like college is a great example. College is a weird place because the population is huge in a lot of colleges, so the opportunity is big. And then once you leave college, it feels like the opportunity starts shrinking depending on where you are or that. It's kind of like looking at it that way is part of it as well.
Absolutely. And you're touching your finger in all the right levels, right? So it's like there's sort of the very aggregate level, just number of people or number of potential partners, like, you know, college or meeting lots of people, having lots of interaction places or sports or NGOs or any leisure activities or organized religion or you, what have you, organized politics, whatever works for you, you know, having a lot of encounter points, this already ups your odds. But then if you drill a bit finer and your art example in a way is doing that, you can think about, okay, where do the people gather that hold my same values, that have the same, I don't know, open-mindedness, so they have the same curiosity or the same, you know, interest in wellness, what, you know, whatever it is, then you can think about where do they gather, where they are they more frequent? Are there maybe, you know, colleges where there are more of these colleges that are, you know, more active in some sports or more active in some, you know, social area, social justice, you know, depending on what you're looking for, you can drill a bit more finely. And there's an interest group for almost everything. And exactly. All of this, in a way, influences your odds.
So in some ways, if you were going to college and you were saying, I would like to find, you know, a partner in college, some of that process of the college you go to may be dependent upon the values of that college or the types of groups that are there as part of the decision-making process, not just the academic side of it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's a very good point. And it's the gender ratio again, because some faculties, you know, like engineering, physics, you know, you have more men, and some, you know, pedagogy, psychology, you have more women. So the gender ratio does play a role. The academics, of course, play a role. That's a value in itself in a way, you know, to what extent does academic excellence matter to me? If it really matters a lot, you know, I want to be in a place where it matters to the others. But absolutely other courses as well, you know, is this a university very active on the environment? Is it very active on social justice? Is it very active in an area that's, you know, in athletics? In an area that really, you know, matters to me and I want a partner that likes the same things, or in the arts, or, you know, it's absolutely, that's a very valid factor. Because, you know, like, you know, a lot of people would probably be shocked at this consideration. They would think, okay, you should only select your college based on the academic excellence. But if you think very long term, what makes you happiest is not wealth and prestige. It's really the quality of your relationships. And interestingly, this has been studied with, you know, the original cohort of Harvard graduates.
Yes.
A really super long-term study, which you may know, right? The Grant Happiness study on the Harvard graduates and their descendants. So like originally, I think some 700 Chinese men, because there were men at the time, but now their descendants and wives and partners and like sort of 1,300 people. And it's very, very clear that, you know, the quality of your relationships outranks everything else. Yeah, a very good reason to choose where you go.
I have read the book, The Good Life, that talks about that study. And I've done several lectures on that study, the ongoing study. So I'm very familiar with it. And it has driven a good part of my kind of value system, driven the work that I do, mentorship and things of that nature. And it's funny, as you talk about like wealth, prestige, all that, why do we still think that's more important than clearly a super longitudinal study that is incredible? What's the disconnect? Why we haven't put that together just yet?
You know, before our podcast, I did a few LinkedIn polls, right? Because I wanted to get at this. Mm-hmm. And so I ran for different age groups. I ran a poll on, you know, what do you most worry about? You know, your relationships, quality of relationships, economic, financial stability, climate change. And I also asked what makes you happiest. So people answered differently. I gave them the same categories to choose each time. So from this, so people like 70% worry about economic and financial stability and only 15% about, you know, finding the right partner, the quality of their relationships. So 70% really worry. And if you ask for happiness, already 50, 55% say, well, relationships make me happiest and wealth and income, not quite so much. So I think it's just a dichotomy that we are so loss averse. We're so afraid of failing economically that we invest a lot there and you know, manage our risks around that a lot. And there's some trade-off, right? And then we lose some attention for the importance of relationships. This is what I conclude from the survey. And the other thing is, in a way, it's to an extent, it's a false trade-off. Because, you know, who you date, mate, and marry, really influences how successful you will be, and the other way around. Mm-hmm. You know, it can be a very fruitful relationship if you have a partner that really supports you in your dreams and in your career, in your hassles. That's worth so much. I think it's a worry that gets the better of our attention, unfortunately.
And this, do you feel also like you mentioned generational before? Do you feel like this is somewhat generational, where people of the past have very well, I think about like, if you think about in America, especially from the Depression era of the 1920s on, there's a very scarcity-based mentality, and maybe rightfully so, because people lost everything. And then now you move up in time and people are saving money, and everything's about saving money, having stability, this American dream idea, and it's all about work, working a lot, and having that nest egg and retirement that we've maybe pushed people into this idea that you're working to retire, you're going to school to have a great job, you know, those relationships, don't worry about that type of thing. I feel like a shift is happening in there, but there's still a little bit of a transition period I sense with this. We're fighting this concept of, I know this is better for me, but I still need to like make a lot of money. Like, we're fighting that. That's what it feels like, you know?
You're totally right. Like, on the one hand, you know, Gen Z and already the millennials got a few things right. They like prioritized social causes, they prioritized purpose over wealth to an extent when it comes to choosing where to work and how to work. And you see that also there's great data from online dating. So the younger generations are very, very pressed online at the different apps. And they really value inner values, authenticity, honesty, a very value-oriented generation, and to that extent, a very relationship-oriented generation. But that's overlaying, and you described it really well. It's the fight is because it's overlaying another trend, and that's the trend towards more inequality. Unfortunately, most Western nations have become more unequal since the 1970s, and it's a process that's hard to stop. So sometimes the gap is so wide that no American dream can bridge it. No social mobility can get you from the very bottom to the very top in one generation. It's incredibly hard. And this has become much, much harder. And with that, of course, the worry has become stronger. You know, like, you need two incomes. One income doesn't stretch as far. People have felt it, and they do feel it in comparison to their parents and grandparents as well. So these two trends are there, and young people feel the inequality trend as well, and the lower social mobility in our generation. So that risks, in a way, diluting their strong value and relationship orientation.
Right. And I mean, if you think about it, it's very difficult for a younger person in these generations to buy a home, to afford moving into homes, therefore you're living in apartments or with your parents for a much longer period than in the past. And the opportunity to actually move into, say, the housing market is such a high bar now that that has to influence romantic relationships as a trickle down of like, well, I mean, I don't want to have somebody over my apartment when I'm sharing with two friends all the time or with my parents. It almost delays this part of life that I never had that. Like I just moved out once I was in college and I just moved up after that. It was affordable for me to keep moving up. And this generation, I think, is struggling tremendously with that mobility.
No, absolutely. And it's true that home ownership is a big part of this this inequality in wealth, as it's, you know, also not very sensitive to inflation, while other savings are sensitive to inflation. So that can, you know, open the gap even wider. When it comes to housing, there's a fellow economist whom I like to read a lot, Daryl Fairweather. She's the chief economist of Redfin. And she has a lot of very interesting advice for policy as well to keep this housing gap to open further. And one of her advice is to tax land that's not being used. So land value tax. And I think that's very good advice. So yeah, definitely there's something to be done about the inequality and wealth gaps opening further.
So you mentioned about dating apps, and I think this is a good segue into that. What do the statistics bear out in regards to, or what do you know related to preference in dating apps? Do they do a good job of promoting preference that a good matching system for preferences?
That's an excellent question. It's the apps are becoming ever more sophisticated in that, and they're using artificial intelligence. So Match.com and apps like Keeper AI are developing very sophisticated models to create good matches. Some apps, it worked towards a short-term market. And then the question is, what is the match for you? Do you want it in the short-term? Do you want short-term dating? Or do you want a stable relationship? Do you want a lifelong relationship? So several apps like, say, Tinder and even Bumble don't serve you that well for a very long-term relationship. And part of that is that they give the illusion that you have a lot of choice. And in reality, you don't have that choice. But they don't have so much of an incentive to let their customers know, you don't really have that much choice, right? So they maximize sort of short-term interaction more than long-term relationships. And the younger generations now, you have like 80-90% are online, are connected to these things. So it is a big, you know, market, as an economist would say, and it's definitely, you know, a place where you can find somebody who matches your preferences very well. But there are other apps like Match.com, who's been working on this for a long time. And I would imagine that currently their AI-sponsored algorithm works very well to get you, you know, something close to your preferences. And there's an app that is particularly for the marriage-minded. Their goal is, you know, to create long-term relationships in relatively short time to match you with somebody who, with very good odds for long-term relationships. And they studied the literature, they studied the research on this and fed their artificial intelligence algorithm. And, they're relatively new. They're still sort of a startup, but I think that's a space to watch. They could potentially be doing relatively well.
I mean, I have experience with Match.com. I met my wife on Match.com.
Really? Back in
2003. This was like a long time ago.
Yeah, so they're ready. Yeah,
20 years ago when there wasn't it wasn't in heavy use the way it is now. And certainly, I'm not sure about any AI or any type of algorithms, but I did like the preference aspect of it because I didn't want to waste my time. That was my whole thing. I was tired of wasting my time, like not knowing, like if this person was in this phase of their life or not, what they were looking for. And as a younger person, when I was like 23, 24, I knew what I wanted. I wanted a long-term relationship, which was very difficult to find when you're that age, like especially in the early 2000s. And I just was tired of wasting my time for that. And it worked out incredibly well, going our 20-year wedding anniversary this summer. It's been wonderful.
Wow, yes.
But because we got past all of the, how do I say it? The stuff that didn't was like pointless. It was like, okay, this is what I want. This is what you want. This lines up. And it was synergy very quickly because of that. And I wonder, like, do the current versions of these apps, you said, like, the thing that got me was the choice, like the illusion of choice. Can you talk more about that? Like, I was curious about that.
Yeah. First, let me quickly come back to a super essential point that you made, time. You know, one illusion that we all have to an extent is that we live forever. But it's not true. Our days are numbered, right? When people come to me for advice, the first thing I tell them is, number your days. Your days are numbered, right? You are working with an ultimatum. And it's very, very important in our mindset. You know, we have all of us sort of a series of deadlines in our life. And some of them are physical. They're imposed on us, you know, a reproductive window. Until when can we very productively do a certain job? In some, you know, businesses like acting or modeling, you clearly have a productive life cycle. And a lot of people don't work with those windows and they forget about them and drift through them. So when you're the first thing you got to have clear is your days are numbered and you got to number them. And basically all people who got that right in their head married relatively soon and married well, I've observed among my clients. So I'm very grateful for your case study. And so if you have that attitude and you find a partner with that attitude, you're on a whole different level of communication, on a whole different level of authenticity, like you described, right? You know, this is what I want. This is what you want. This is less about, oh, you know, let's drift here. Let's go about chemistry. How do we feel? Now, this is about very concrete things. What works for me? What doesn't work for me? And another thing I advise with this time management is that in the very beginning, when you just go for coffees, it's very superficial. Date various people at the same time and have very clear in your head what are like the five non-negotiables. And people who clearly don't meet one of them by the second date, you can't see again. And it's just for time management. It's not to offend anyone, but, you know, to respect both of your time. And then you do come much more quickly to a decision. And now your question was on the choice illusion. There's this time illusion, which is just as important. And there's the choice illusion where, you know, what we find in the long run, what works well is that relatively like-minded people or relatively similar people get along very well. So, and that's true for straight and gay couples. So, you know, if you're a birds of a feather flock together, meaning you like the same things, you mention the big five, the ocean, right? Your right. Openness to things, conscientiousness, you know, these sort of key personality characteristics. If you need to be similar for it to work out. And that's true for attractiveness. That's true for height, right? For superficial criteria where, you know, we should ask second questions about because they're obviously not that relevant, but it does matter. So it's important to know where you stand, who you are, and who will match you well, and not think, oh, you know, it will work well with somebody who has very different characteristics, who doesn't really have my sense of humor, or it will work really well with this person who doesn't like sports, although I like sports, but, you know, they just look so nice. And, you know, and really drilling down to what works for you and reducing this vast choice is very important.
You mentioned something, I think this was in your TED talk, and I found this to be so fascinating. I talked to my wife about it immediately afterwards. I think you mentioned, please correct me if I'm wrong, that in a very solid relationship over a long period of time, that the research bears out that you become more alike each other. As you get older together, you start this, there's like a synergy that starts to come together. I was like, oh, I'm experiencing that big time. My relationship. I feel like I've become closer to my wife's like environmentalism, her sensitivity, sustainability, all that. and that actually has brought us much closer throughout the years for things like that. So I wonder if you could talk about that a little bit.
No, absolutely. And that's what the evidence says. I'm not sure I mentioned it in the TED, but absolutely there is strong empirical evidence on exactly this happening. So there is, on most categories, values, humor, looks and background, people, you know, a match early on. But there's one category where opposites tend to attract each other, and that is spending habits. You know, people who are very generous and people who are big savers attract each other and marry. But what you do? So there's even somebody, Scott Ricky, wrote a whole book about that, sort of spendthrift and tightwads. Came out recently. Yeah. So that's, and I still need to read it, but like I just read the excerpt and I thought that's really interesting. So what you find is this can, of course, then cause a bit of conflict at the beginning, but you do find a convergence in these, you know, traits where people are still different. And this is spending habits is one that's very well researched. But there are others where the causes where, you know, how much emphasis you put on health and healthy eating or sports, people tend to converge over time. Even, the taste in movies or literature, there's some convergence, right? Because you have to. I mean, you want to spend your leisure together, right? So you have to somehow meet in the middle. And definitely there is some convergence.
I just found that to be so fascinating. I think things become very real to you when you're experiencing that yourself. You're like, oh, yeah, I identify with that. I see that. And then it's also interesting just observationally when you see two people together and you like, I don't know, have you ever seen a couple of people together and you're like, this just feels wrong. Like, it's just like, I don't see them. Like, you get a sense like these, I don't know how they're like with each other, you know, like, and then and sometimes you're like, maybe that works. But I've talked to my wife about it. Sometimes you see it and you just realize, like, I don't think they're going to be together in the future. Like, you just, something's off. And maybe one of these qualities are off between the, I don't know. It's just a feeling I get. But it often turns out right a lot, actually. And sometimes I don't think the people themselves see that in themselves. I don't know. I may be way off on that. But it's just like, just a feeling. Certainly no statistics behind it. But certainly there's people you think, wow, how do these people get together and they're great together? And then some people you're like, yeah, that's not going anywhere. You just kind of know it, you know, type, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's like I've seen most of the cases, I must say, in college when you're still finding your way and you're finding out what you want. There's some experimentation and yes, yeah. Then people stay together. But also, I think you know, in a way, you're touching up on a deeper issue here. That's mental health and relationships, right? There's if you're not completely at peace with yourself and you haven't really found yourself yet, then there's some, you know, something that makes you unhappy about yourself, something that makes you unhappy in your life. You unconsciously look for healing from the other person. And that's not good, right? If you're not well yet yourself, you look for the wrong things. You might be, you know, a person with a tough childhood that are consciously looking for a partner that keeps you on edge, that keeps you walking on eggshells, because that's what you're used to. But it's not right, and it won't keep you right in the long run. You need to step back, be alone, and get well in yourself first. So there's a strong evidence in a couple of papers also coming out relatively recently saying that, you know, your mental health and the quality of your relationship afterwards are really correlated. So, and there's a link in both relationships of both directions, of course. So you're in a happy relationship, you're happier, you're mentally better. That's a very strong relationship. But there's also, of course, a relationship between you being mentally well and choosing the right person for yourself. And I've seen a few cases where, you know, people were driven by old wounds that weren't healed and therefore picked people who really weren't good for them or really didn't match well and they weren't good for each other. So that's, that's sometimes the case.
It's very interesting. I wonder where all this is headed, like with dating apps and the statistics behind it, like you mentioned. And in your ideal situation, what would be the best way for someone to put the odds in their favor? If you could like make like really like really put something together. And you're like, this is the crux of this. This is how I'm going to ensure the best possible chance for this.
So the two steps we mentioned are the first ones to do, right? Realize, you know, your life will be limited. Hopefully it'll be very long and very healthy, but it will be limited and your days are numbered. And you have a few internal deadlines, which are your own, and you need to manage with, right? And then you need to realize, in this life, you won't be drifting towards one person. There will be a few people you'll do very well with, and you need to find them and you need to take decisions. And then, this is clear, sit down with yourself and decide what are your five non-negotiables. And then go out there, right? By all means, be on all the apps, right? They need to be transparent. They need to be in competition with each other. Then they end up serving people well. And you need to know what they do for people. And the ones you feel comfortable with, by all means, you know, put yourself out on those apps. And once you know what your five non-negotiables are, and you start dating in parallel, make sure you don't see a person that doesn't meet them more than twice, just to respect the time and respect this. I think that's really, these are the basics for the odds. And you've done a lot if you do that. And then the third thing will be, you know, choose your environment. If you know what's close to your heart, what your values are, what your purpose is in this life, what you want to express in this life, choose environments where people go who have those same values. And make sure, you know, to meet often and interact frequently. With that, you've covered your basis really, really well. And then there's a paper that says, you know, you really only need to get to know 12 people. You need to get to know 12 people. And if between the first 12 and the next one or the best one of those 12, if you make a choice, you'll be happy with. You don't need to get going 20s early. No, 12 people on average, you know, is statistically fine to find the best person.
Wow, that's really interesting. I never heard that before. 12 people. Interesting. Wow, that's incredible. It's incredible information. I mean, I think this is, it's interesting. Most of my friends are single. Like, I'm going to say almost all of them are single, and which I find very strange. Because back in the day, I never had friends that were single. But I wonder if there's any statistics on an increasing level of people not wanting to be in long-term relationships or putting off being in something that is more long-term, and how that influences the way they pick people and things of that nature.
What you do find is that people marry later and later, right? And then sometimes people get confused by the statistics because you take, say, the population 20 to 55 and the marriage rate is down. But the overall likelihood to get married isn't down that much because the 55 plus, you know, several people marry for the first time after that. So your overall likelihood to ever get married in America is still like 95%, right? But several of these are now first-time marriages after 50. And therefore, you know, any aggregate statistic looks a bit scary, but you need to know, you know. And in some countries like Britain, your odds to get married at all have never been higher, right? But still, people marry later and later. And the different factors that lead us to postpone marriage. One is our education spans got longer. People add, you know, degrees, and then they add post-grad degrees. You may just be out of college, but a recession may hit. You may not feel economically ready. And then again, the social equality, the economic equality we were talking about, you know, the marriage rate for people with a college degree and the relatively wealthier is much, much higher than the marriage rate for the relatively less wealthy. So the more people you have in that category, the less comfortable they will feel to commit because this, you know, again, we get back to our original theme that the economic worries sometimes are so strong, they cloud out what really matters. And that also leads to people, you know, being less ready to commit or feeling less secure about it, just having a bigger worry on their mind.
So funny, the the economics of living and the importance of relationships are colliding right now tremendously, and maybe globally at this point, and making us have very interesting decisions about who we get with, when we get with those folks, and really heavily influencing our choices. Because if the choice is primarily based off of money, what I'm hearing is that it may be pretty detrimental to the quality of your relationship. But if the choice is based off of your preferences and understanding that relationships are the main thing, and that what creates a happy life, you're more than likely going to have better odds at having a better relationship with someone.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. And then there's, there's this broader environment of economic security or instability we immediately can't do so much about. But it's also something to think about, right? Do we want our society to be a bit more secure? Do we want it to be more stable? Do we want to become active in that space, right? And make sure that, this inequality doesn't rise further and we, get behind some good causes of, taxing the right things and, not so much others. And so that's also cause to get behind working on the system, even as an individual, it's hard. But if you team up, it's not quite that hard. But you're absolutely right. At the individual level, prioritizing relationships makes for lifelong happiness
And would you say, I know this is kind of love and economics, but would you say these same lessons would apply to friendship and other types of relationships, or is that very different in your mind?
Some things are very similar. So like how friendships form, this opportunity and preference is very similar. So you end up befriending the people that were in your college dorm, right? The people you run into, the people whose way you cross just by being there. So again, your environment drives a lot of friendships. We tend to be a bit more tolerant of difference in our friendships. So you can have opposing views on politics, opposing views on religion,
right?
On several things. You can be very different on the five ocean, right? In your friendships. And it may be enriching because you consume your friendship at a lower dose, basically, right? You
do in an hour.
And so we're less tolerant of these differences in marriage or in long-term committed relationships.
We consume this at a lower dose. I've never heard that. That's amazing. That's a great way of putting that, Rebecca.
It's also a recipe. If you find a person difficult, you don't necessarily need to cut them out. You just need to lower the dose.
You actually operationalized this for me. I've had kind of a, I would say more informal way of doing that, but kind of formal, like I have like tier my relationship, like I tier my friendships. I'm sorry, anybody listen to this, you're my friend. I'm sorry, this is how I do it. But I will definitely have people where I prefer, my preference is to spend more time with them. So they may be in this higher tier. And then I may have other people, it doesn't mean that I don't like them. I just maybe we don't have as much, the dosage, I don't want the dosage to be as high. So I'll spend time with them less. And then I may have friends that I'm acquaintance with, we're friends, but we're kind of on like the lowest dosage, but not because I don't like them. It's just that maybe we just don't have a huge amount in common socially for that. And that's how I kind of decide who I spend more time with for that. And usually it's the people, my preference is always to spend time with people that are a little risky in their behavior. They like to hang out a lot. They're very social people. They're very funny. And if a person is not those things, I tend to spend less time with them for that. So I've like got my preference down big time within friendship. But the dosage part, that's an interesting way of looking at that.
That's great. It sounds like you've got it all sorted out. That's awesome. Yeah. And I've also found that, when we spend time in different places or in different continents and in some neighborhoods, some neighbors who are there permanently don't like a specific neighbor so much, but I get very well along with them. But one reason is that I dip in and out. I'm just there frequently and they don't have that luxury. So I see why they might take different choices. And yeah, I'm similar. I have some friends who there's some aspects we have a lot in common and we enrich each other a lot. In some aspects, not so much. So yeah, it's just giving each other that space. Makes sense.
It does. Wow, this has been very informative. And I want to say thank you so much, Rebecca, for giving me your time. It is a currency that I value the most. And thank you for the currency of your time and your tremendous insight, education, and the economist mind to love. I appreciate that so much.
Thank you so much, Dr. D. This has been wonderful.
So tell the audience, because, you know, we're going to be sharing this all over the place, and I think it's going to be very valuable information. How can people learn more about you and your work in this area?
So the best thing currently is really to follow me on LinkedIn. I'm relatively easy to find, you know, with my name. And every new insight I find that is of relevance for more people, I publish on LinkedIn. And I have a newsletter coming out soon where I will condense some of these lessons that we've discussed today in a series. So hopefully that will be very enriching for people. And always, you know, I connect with lots of people on LinkedIn. Feel free to shoot me questions, and I do my best to answer them as well.
Thank you so much, Rebecca. And we will be in touch. I appreciate you.
Thank you.